version of the story of the Buddha's life. There's actually many versions of that story, not just one, but in one version of that story of the Buddha's life, the story goes that after he sat under the Bodhi tree, like that, that's a statue of him in his earth-touching mudra, his enlightenment mudra. So after he sat under the Bodhi tree and meditated for 6 years, he did get up to go to the bathroom in those 6 years, but he meditated for 6 years, and that was a joke. I got one laugh. After he was meditating for 6 years, he sat down one day and decided, I'm going to stay here under this tree until I attain enlightenment. I'm going to stay here. Real determination. And he was beset by obstacles the whole night through. And then as the sun rose, the story goes, over the Indian plains, he awoke to the truth, his selflessness. So in one version of that story, after he awakes, that same morning, just a little bit after he awakes, he suddenly has a memory that comes back to him. And in the memory, he is a 3-year-old boy, and he's on his father's shoulders, walking through a field in the sunshine, and he's happy for no reason in this memory. Happy for no reason, the way children can be. And also he remembered that at that time, he was awake. Now, I love that story, that version of the story, because it gestures to the state of awakeness that the Buddha had experienced and connects it somehow to this childlike innocence, this wide-eyed wakefulness that all of us have experienced at some point in our young childhood, when things were fresh and things were new, and we didn't have a lot of conceptual movement in the mind. And I also like this version of the story because there's something about it that points to an embodied experience, this happy for no reason child. And again, he found himself, after his enlightenment experience, happy without needing conditions, happy for no reason, this notion. But what I wanted to introduce this story because of the embodied side of it, the joy and the sense of the joy in wakefulness and the sense that we have been there before that comes with that story, this notion that to be awake is not so much the discovery of some special new state, but rather a kind of coming home to something we have known deep within forever, that notion. So also in this version of the story of the Buddha's life, the story goes that he then began to wander throughout the Indian countryside, and that's actually consistent across the versions of the Buddha's life, that he couldn't figure out how or if how to put into words what he'd experienced, and also if he should even try, because it wasn't something he could put into words. So instead of speaking about it, he wandered for quite a while, for a couple of weeks. And somewhere in those 2 weeks, this version of the story goes, a young woman who was wandering through a field or walking through a field on the path, on the same path he was walking on, going this way, and he was going this way, when she began to come near him, she saw that he looked different in some way, radiant. And she asked him, because he looked different, "What are you?" she asked him. And he didn't answer. There was silence. He was still keeping his silence, his noble silence. And then she said, "Are you a god?" And there was silence. She said, "Are you a demon?" And there was silence. She said, "Are you a spirit?" And silence. "Are you a man?" Silence. And finally, after a long pause, he said, "I am awake." That was his answer. "I am awake." So he wasn't so much speaking from this identity, these many identities we have, man, woman, our job. You know, we too have those identities. He didn't answer from the identity. He didn't say, "I'm a yogi, I'm a meditator, I'm a guru." He didn't even say, I'm a person. He said, "I am awake." He answered from his state. He answered from the state of wakefulness. And again, this word, the word, wakefulness, Buddha, or Bodhi, Buddha, Bodhi, Sanjay in the Tibetan, carries this connotation of innate openness, carries a connotation of awareness. So something not so far away from the human condition. We all are conscious. When we hear the word awake, we know, at least from our everyday experience, what it means to be asleep and what it means to be awake. So something not so extraordinary in one way extraordinary. What the Buddha did was extraordinary. But another way, inherent somehow, like the experience that he had as a child, remembering that experience. So our path, the path of meditation, is largely about this process of going from a state of unconsciousness, of being caught or snagged by our habitual mind, to a process of being present, fully present and awake. This notion of coming into relationship with our present experience without a lot of overlay. Or, to put it in the words of the Buddha, without clinging, without clinging, without grasping, but just being with what we are experiencing. So So when we hear a word like awake and might associate that with consciousness, with the mind, and even words like clinging with the mind, there's a lot of talk in Buddhism about the mind. And all of you, many of you, have probably spent years, certainly some of you, maybe many of you, associating Buddhism with the mind. And in fact, there's a lot of reason to do so, right? The practice of meditation, we still the body, and then we grapple with this very restless, very graspy, very undisciplined and challenging mind. So our practice is largely about coming to terms with the mind and its hold on us and the way that it pulls us into cycles of dis-ease, dukkha, right? So when I was back when I was a college student, one of the very first Dharma books that I had on my shelf, my own personal Dharma book, not something I borrowed from somebody else, but actually one of the ones I actually bought, my first book that I bought that was a Dharma book, was the Dhammapada. I don't know if any of you have read the Dhammapada, but it's a whole collection of sayings of the Buddha. It's very practical. It's lots of little aphorisms about ethics and patience and meditation and concentration. It's a very practical kind of manual for how to live one's life. There's a lot of aphorisms around that. And there was one particular one that I really latched onto and memorized. And it was, the mind is the chief and takes the lead. The body and the speech follow like a cart follows a horse. And for some reason, that one really, really hooked my attention because it made so very much sense, right? That what we think, if we think something, ideas are so powerful. If we have an idea, then the rest of our being will follow that idea. If we have a thought, if we have a plan, right, our body and our speech are going to go with that plan. That the mind has a great grasp over our physical being and our verbal self. So that I really remember being taken with that particular phrase, that aphorism in the Dhammapada. And at the same time that I was studying the Buddha Dharma like that, I was also taking yoga from this Hindu yogi in Kathmandu, back when I was 20. I was sort of doing the Buddhism thing on one hand, and I was doing the yoga thing on the other hand. And somehow I really came to believe that Buddhism was all about the mind. I kind of simplified things a little bit. And that yoga was all about the body. And that I had to choose. If I was going to really focus on something, I really had to choose either the body, had to go with the body, or I had to go with the mind. And at the time, it was really, it felt like Sophie's Choice. I remember sort of being that age and just like, I can't have both. I can't have both. It felt like I couldn't have both, that I had to go one way or the other. And And so I went along the path of studying Buddhism and held for many years in my this belief, and very much supported by many of the teachings of Buddhism, for sure. The mind is the chief and takes the lead, and the body and the speech follow like a cart follows the horse. It seemed to make sense. So, but at a certain point, I started to notice that that wasn't all that the Buddha taught. Of course, he taught other things as well. But for many years, I was very, very focused on this idea that Buddhism was really about the mind. And just sharing a little bit of my own story, I began to forget about the body, actually, and get very, very caught up in this idea that my meditation, my liberation, that liberation in general was going to be happening in the mind. Forgot about the body. Didn't pay attention to the body, really. So I think all of us who practice meditation can are at a risk for this, of letting go of the notion of the body, or seeing the body as subservient somehow to the mind. And so I want to talk a little bit tonight just about how awakening doesn't have to happen from the top down. And in fact, it might even be harder to awaken from the top down than from the bottom up. So in other words, from the mind, working mostly with the mind, and then making that the path, and not so much paying attention to the body, there's a possibility we can actually awaken from the bottom up. And that idea actually is very much a piece of the Buddha's teaching. So in the Satipatthana Sutra, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, the very first foundation of mindfulness that the Buddha presents and offers up is this mindfulness of the body. And he says that's where we should begin. Resting attention on the body, and then moving from there to mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of thoughts, and then mindfulness of phenomena. But starting as our basis, as our foundation, as the temple with the body. So I'm just curious, how many people in here had an experience similar to mine that they really have focused, either now focus on or have focused on Buddhism as being principally about the mind and working with the mind? Anyone? Okay. Just curious. Okay, it's nice to know I'm not alone in this room. And I'm also not discounting the mind as an important frontier to work on, but I'm just pointing out that we can become one-sided about our practice. So I just wanted to bring in the body this evening. So if we look more closely at Buddhist sources like the Satipatthana Sutra, and actually cutting across traditions, including the Zen tradition and also the Tibetan tradition, as well as Vipassana tradition, the more you look, the more you'll see this presence of the body as an anchor for practice, but not only that, but the body as an actual source of wisdom. So one more short, small story. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a maybe the most famous sort of Buddha-like figure, saint-like figure, is this mountain cave meditator named Milarepa. And in his life story, he's going off to the mountains to meditate, essentially like the Buddha, until I wake up, right? That's his vow. I'm going to go off into the mountains. I'm going to meditate until I wake up, until I experience enlightenment, until I'm free of suffering. I'm going to go up to these mountains. And until that time, I'm not really going to return to society. So he made a similar vow to this, to the Buddha's vow. Only he's in Tibet. This is 1,000 years later, after the Buddha's time. So the story goes that he went to his teacher, Marpa, who was this really irritable old farmer. I love that there are all these different kinds of saints in the Buddhist tradition. It's just never one size fits all, which is a good lesson for us, right? That it isn't about becoming like the Buddha. It's about becoming your best self. So anyway, this particular guy, Marpa, was a farmer, which I think is so cool. A Buddha farmer, right? He's a farmer. And he was also really irritable. It was just sort of his personality. It's also kind of nice to know that an irritable farmer could be awakened, right? So he's the teacher of this yogi, Milarepa. And they're sitting in their little hut, and Milarepa says, I'm leaving, and I'm going to go into, like the Buddha, until I wake up. I'm going to go and meditate in the mountains. And this is a very sad parting, because they know they may never see each other again. So think of your closest mentor or closest relative, and this sense of you're parting and you're going off to, you can imagine, you know, going off, and maybe some of you have done this, gone a long retreat. There's a kind of poignancy to leaving behind the loved one. So he's leaving behind his dearest teacher, maybe forever, especially when you think about Tibet, the long distances, and it's not like there was any email or cell phone, so there was just no, if someone died, you didn't even know. Right? You had to actually come all the way back, months and months and months on a horse, to find out if someone was even still alive. So he was saying to his teacher, Marpa, you know, I'm going up into the mountains. I need, can you give me an instruction? So he gave him full instructions of what to do on his retreat in the mountains. And then the very last minute, he handed him this scroll, and it was sealed inside of an amulet. So you think of a metal amulet, maybe, you know, this size. It's sealed inside of an amulet the size of a fist. There's a scroll in there, and he says, I want, and it's sealed up. And he says, I want you to take this and hold on to it. And when you're really, really, really at your bottom, when things are really tough on your retreat, I want you to open it. Because in here are the instructions that will wake you up. Right? So he's got the scroll. Now, right, we're all pretty curious. Like, what's that? That sounds so cool. What is that? We'd all like that scroll, right? So it's all sealed up. And Milarepa, the yogi, he takes it and he wraps it inside of his top knot. He's got this long flowing hair. So he wraps like his hair all up on his head, and he sticks the scroll in this top knot. And then he goes off on his meditation retreat. And he's meditating for years and years and years and years. Many years go by, and he has an obstacle. And in his obstacle, he's actually, in the description of what's going on, he's getting really ascetic. and he's not eating very much, and he's like striving, and he's like, why can't I wake up? And I just am getting worse and worse. You know, if any of you have been on a week-long retreat, you've been through something like this. It's not a mystery to us meditator, people who meditate, who are on a path. You know, we hit these obstacles, but his was really bad, and he just couldn't get beyond it. And he'd been waiting a long time. He didn't want to open the scroll until he knew he was really at his bottom. So he, at this point, he really does start to think, I am really at my bottom. And he starts to think about leaving retreat, and that's how he knows that he's at his bottom. He's really thinking he's just going to break retreat. And he's depressed, and he's hopeless. He feels hopeless. So the scroll, he knows, is up there, and he's been waiting, but he doesn't want to open it too soon. He wants to see if he can get over it. But this one, he really is really doesn't think he's going to make it. So he pulls the scroll down, and he opens the scroll up. What do you think's in there? Anyone? Oh, that's pretty good. I like that. It could have said that. Yeah. It sort of did. So what it was, and you probably wouldn't guess it necessarily, but what it was is all these instructions on physical yoga. Isn't that crazy? Essentially, and these are a transmission within the Tibetan tradition, actual physical movements, but essentially, the instructions were, get out of your head and get into your body. Get out of your head and get into your body. Those were the instructions. And then, and do movement. Don't just meditate, move, and do mindful movement. And that's going to be the thing that will get you into awakening. That will get you into awakening. So he applied that instruction, and the story goes that it was that instruction of everything else that he had learned in his path of meditation that actually woke him up. So I'm just bringing this example in to just illustrate that over the course of Buddhist history, the body is very critical to our practice. And yet we can really think it's all about the mind and struggle a lot with the mind, especially when we're on the cushion. Oh, all these thoughts, and oh, I'm so distracted, and oh, I can't wake up, and oh, I'm so dull. The swirling of this, we can get into a lot of push and pull with it. So we have an option, and that is to drop down and be with the body. So what would we get out of that? So I want to bring up four ways that the body teaches us wakefulness. I'm just pulling out four. I could maybe pull out more, but these are maybe some of my favorite points of what the body does. Why would we drop down? What happens? And what happened with Milarepa when he dropped down, perhaps? We don't know. We can't talk to him now. But what happens? So the first thing that happens when we drop down into the body is we become present. The mind is so very involved in our thoughts about the past, in ruminating, in processing our past, ruminating about the past, worrying about the past, reliving the past, and anticipating the future, worrying about the future, following after thoughts about the future, and very rarely are we just here now. The body is always here now, if we listen to it. The feeling body, the feeling of our body on the cushion, the feeling of the wind on our skin, or the air on our skin, the feeling of the breath coming in and out of our nostrils is happening not in the past and not in the future. It's happening right now, right now. So as soon as we turn attention to the body, we've gone from past and present right into the now. It's like an anchor here, now. Presence, the body's presence. The second dimension of the body that makes it such a good support for meditation is the body teaches naturalness. So you may wonder, what do I mean by the body teaches naturalness? So I mean, if you observe the body, I mean, just almost in the same way that a scientist observes the body, it self-regulates. It has a way of staying in balance. Like on the cellular level, homeostasis, this way of adjusting so that it is in harmony with its environment. The body just does that on its own, doesn't have to think about that. The body is a natural self-balancing organism. If we pay attention to that, you know, the mind is much less self-balancing. The mind is just off on a tangent, and it will run with its ideas. It doesn't know how to pull itself back. But if we think about the analogy of the body's balance, of its homeostasis, it's enacting itself right now, that homeostasis. We can use that perception to teach our mind. When our mind is going way off on a tangent, on its illusory galloping process, creating and spinning our experience, we can remember, oh yeah, I'm really out of balance. How can I bring that back? What's the counterbalance to that particular train that I'm off running on? And what if my mind were the body, how would it balance itself out? So sort of using the body as a kind of analogy for what we can do with the mind. The body teaches balance, naturalness. And third, the body can be a door for us into compassion. The body can teach compassion. The body can teach compassion. Pain, that's something we experience in the body. And we experience it almost daily, right? Almost daily, we experience pain. And we might think that this is my pain. It's my personal pain. It's my backache. It's my headache. It's my stomach ache, right? We do think that way, but we're also in an animal body. We are mammals. We are animals. So in one way, the pain that we are feeling is human pain. It's not our pain alone. It's animal pain. And if we think about that very much, that can bring us to a place of identifying with the pain of others in that moment that we're feeling the pain that we feel in our body. So our body can be a great teacher for us of compassion. connectedness. So once in a while, we'll have some experience with that in our body. For me, a few years ago, I had a frozen shoulder. And that was the first time I didn't even know what a frozen shoulder was. I had no idea, and I got a frozen shoulder. Anyone had a frozen shoulder? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So you know. It can be the most agonizing pain. It can be just excruciating pain. And so this excruciating pain was coming into my shoulder. I was like, oh, there's something really, really wrong here. And then go in and you get it diagnosed. And then it doesn't go away. It's like a year, 6 months to a year. And I never on my radar that such a thing could occur. But what happened, as it happens with all of us, is this sudden whole window opened up to a possibility for empathy. Wow, this is what a frozen shoulder is. And I'm sure I'd heard about a frozen shoulder many times before, and I'd probably just dismissed it like, oh, frozen shoulder, what is she complaining about, right? But then after the frozen shoulder, now when I hear of someone a frozen shoulder, I just like, oh, you know, oh, yes, I get it. I know what you're feeling. So these painful experiences in the body. Our body can teach us compassion better in some ways than anything else. Our body can teach us compassion. And finally, the last dimension of the body that I want to mention, and then we'll just open it up for discussion and questions, and maybe, or we'll do a dyad, we'll see. Is that the body teaches us non-conceptuality. The body teaches us non-conceptuality. Our mind has full of thoughts, ideas, opinions, judgments, interpretations. The body has no particular ideas about itself. It just is. It's so good at being just is the body. It's teaching us how to be. Just be, the body says. The mind says, oh, all kinds of things. A couple of years ago, I was at a conference, and there was a Buddhist monk there at the conference. I don't even remember it was a panel discussion. I don't even remember what the topic was. But he said something that I had never heard anyone say before, although I'm sure it's been said before. I'd certainly never heard a Buddhist monk say anything of this nature, and I was just floored. It was the one thing that I remembered most from the conference because it was so unusual for me. I've spent a lot of time around Buddhist monks in my life. I used to be one, so. He said, the body is more honest than the mind. The mind will lie a blue streak, but the body tells the truth. And I was just so grateful for him saying that. And it's so true, isn't it? That our mind will tell us all kinds of stories about how we feel. So in a certain situation that makes us really angry, for example, our mind will say, I'm not angry. I'm not angry at all. You know, I feel just fine about this, right? That's our mind. Our mind is saying that. But our body is not saying that. Our body's saying, I'm furious, right? If we listen, sometimes the body will know before our mind knows how we actually feel about something, right? The body can tell. Or the body might be afraid, and our mind is saying, I'm not afraid. But the body's saying, this is not a safe situation. We could listen to the body, and the body will tell us, no, this is not safe. The mind will say, spin all kinds of tales. This idea that the body is more honest than the mind is very interesting to reflect on, something we might think about and ask ourselves, is it true? Is the body more honest than the mind? It's true, the body can probably be mistaken also. Oh, definitely, body could be mistaken, right? When we're at a movie, you know, right? You know, we're scared about a scary movie, but nothing's actually scary, right? So the sort of our body mind can react to something, but it's interesting to listen to the body's signals and to see what it's telling us that's underneath the radar of our thinking mind. But I was talking about non-conceptuality, actually, right? Yes. That was sort of another thing. The body tells the truth. But non-conceptuality, the body doesn't have any ideas about itself. It's just being. It's just adjusting. It's just surviving. And in that way, it can be a great teacher for our mind, which is so very conceptual and busy. So I think I'll just open it up for discussion or questions at this point. We can just reflect on this body, mind, conundrum. Yes.
You didn't tell us how you got back to the body. You know that?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Okay.
I mean, how you got back?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. Yeah, I did. I came back to the body. I did. And I'd say that there were two things. One is that after this long process of, did a lot of intensive Buddhist meditation practice and preparation for practice, and then eventually practice, and was in a monastic situation, became a nun, still, I think, lost a lot of touch with my body. I ignored the body through a lot of this process, although we did, part of our training was doing prostrations, and that was actually extremely helpful. That really did get me into my body. That was helpful. But that really wasn't the turning point, because I still had a narrative in my mind for years. I would say until I was in my late 20s, I had a narrative in my mind that this is really all about taming the mind. And the body is my narrative, maybe not fully conscious narrative, but my narrative was that almost like the body is a fetter. The body's a fetter, like a burden. A not fully conscious narrative, but it was definitely there. And then I went into a long retreat situation. And in that long retreat situation, in the middle of it, it was 3 years, and in one and a half years in, my teacher, who was a Tibetan monk, came into our retreat place, and he just announced, like just out of the blue, he said, "Now it's time for the yogas." He just said, "Now it's time for the yogas." And we all looked at each other, what is he talking about? Because literally, we have been sitting in meditation for 1.5 years. I had no idea there was any yogas. What yogas, right? He said, "Now it's time for the yogas." And he brought leotards. I'm not kidding. It was really funny. I mean, it was just shocking to us. And he wore a leotard. Tibetan leotards are, you know, kind of like little things. This is a tradition in Tibet. And then he just, all of a sudden, this different person came out of him, and he was like, "We're doing yoga for all day long, for months. Physical yoga." And along with that went these teachings that the body is the crucible for enlightenment, and the body is the place to wake up, and that these yogas themselves, in the process of doing them, you can wake up. That was part of, that was the narrative of the practice. And actually, there was a combination of huge relief and joy that this was even an idea in the Buddhist tradition. And there was also a little bit of resentment, because I wondered why we hadn't been offered this idea earlier, that the body is the crucible for awakening. So that's what changed for me. That was a big turning point, that the tradition has practices of the body in Vipassana, it's walking meditation. But these are not, I think what was helpful to me was to see that these are not, these practices are not subservient to the other, to the meditation, but they are on equal ground. So that's what happened for me. And then I still think it didn't really fully penetrate. It helped a lot, but there was definitely a time when I also, I think I learned through some experiences, just through being in a monastic situation, at the time that I was realizing I didn't want to be a nun anymore, my whole body was telling me that, and my mind was saying, you are monastic and you must remain so forever. And that was also another moment where I was split. And then it took me a couple of years to actually realize that I could listen to my body and not dismiss it.
So if you take a yoga class in America, so this has been my experience anyway, if you take a yoga class in America, there's like 30 seconds of meditation at the beginning and 30 seconds of meditation in the end, and there's and then remaining hour and 15 minutes or so, there's not a lot of emphasis on what to do with the mind. So I'm curious, when you were taught those physical practices, was there emphasis on paying attention to the sensations? Was there emphasis on what to do with the mind and where to put the attention while you were doing?
It was totally a whole meditation practice. Yeah. It was a concentration practice. You were meditating while you did those movements.
Okay.
But essentially, you know, what's kind of cool is actually the principle of it isn't that mysterious. The essential instruction was to bring body and mind into utter unity. That was the instruction for how to turn it into meditation, was to drop, not be split, body and mind, but to bring body and mind together.
I'm curious, were the movements fairly fast or were they slow?
Fairly fast.
Really? Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. But now I prefer slow yoga. I'm old and creaky.
Oh, thanks for sharing your experience too. That's very enlightening. I was wondering, what was coming up for me as you were talking was in that saying that the body knows truth and that the mind can go on spins out there. That may be very untruthful. I was wondering if we could clarify that by saying that an untrained mind can be what's untruthful, but like a very present mind can be as truthful as the body. Because when you say just in that general way, it makes me feel like there's a split between the two.
I appreciate what you're saying. Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah. Yeah, I think what I was really thinking about was that our thoughts, we don't need to believe everything we think. Most of what we think is transient. Right? But yes, thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. I was I have a question about the instructions from Marpa to Milarepa. Has anyone ever noted that he was a farmer and that he gave instructions about sort of basically doing yoga or doing physical exercises? Since the work of, you know, farmers are very physical by nature. And I asked that because my grandfather was a farmer. He came from Greece, and that's what he knew. And, you know, the fondest memories I have of him are basically going in our backyard and him telling me to just turn over the soil and, you know, plant the things. And so it's a very physical, you know, effort. I'm just wondering if any, if you or others sort of make any connection between the way Marpa was living his life as a farmer and the fact that he was suggesting to get in touch with your body.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident in a way. I mean, there's a lineage of those yogas that were he was carrying that was even all the way in India. So he was, but he did go to India himself to get those teachings in particular. So he was probably a pretty physically embodied guy. Yeah, to be drawn in that direction. I also wonder, I believe that Western Buddhists especially need to balance their meditation with embodiment and embodied practices. And I feel that because, and this is sort of getting at Marpa, the agrarian lifestyle, that's, if you've ever been to Asia, to these Buddhist countries, you've been to these Buddhist countries, some of you probably have, Tibet, the Himalaya, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, and hung out with these farmers, if you've been there, they live a highly physical life. The monks live a highly physical life. I mean, they are carrying water. They are tending the yaks. I mean, these monks are embodied and they're earthy. And they don't need necessarily a whole lot of reminders to be embodied and earthy. But we're just flying away here on the internet. I mean, we're just like, we are off in our minds and running around in our minds and not running around in our bodies. We're not so much, don't have that so much. So I think there's a real, it's important for us to figure out how to bring our principles of meditation into the body, especially for Westerners. But yeah, I think there may be a connection. Maybe Marpa was drawn because of that lifestyle.
Just one quick follow-up question. Do you have any tips? Well, so most of us living in the urban areas aren't farmers, so we don't have that connection to a very earthy type of physical activity, but we have various other kinds of physical activities, whether it be yoga or jogging or whatever. Do you have any tips for sort of bringing mindfulness to certain kinds of, you know, yeah, just regular physical activities?
I think mindfulness is such an important, mindfulness is a way of being. It's not even really a meditation practice. Mindfulness doesn't stop with a cushion. Yeah, so however much we can take what we're doing on the cushion into running, into swimming, into hiking, into gardening, we can turn that into mindfulness practice to the degree that we just decide to make that conscious effort. Then it becomes meditation, in my belief, my experience. That's true. So it doesn't have to be yoga. That's just a vehicle for doing this, but it could be done in, it doesn't matter the activity. I think that there are ways to cut down in the gym. We can gym and lifting weights. You know, that's actually, I find that meditative myself.
Thanks.
Yeah.
When you were mentioning the yoga during your retreat and the emphasis on unifying the body and the mind, can you explain that a little more for people who are into yoga to utilize that more? What would that actually look like?
Yeah. Let me just ask a question. Does this end at 8:30 or 8:45? 8:45, okay, good. So the key instruction is actually in a tiny little phrase, and it's Lungsem Yerme, and that's Tibetan, that phrase, but it translates as prana, mind, inseparable. So one way to think of it is energy, prana, energy, mind, inseparable. In the lineage of Marpa, who was this farmer, and his way of instructing in meditation, that can become an actual enlightenment experience. That if your prana, if your energy, your body's energy, and your mind become deeply fused, you lose the self, and you have an awakening experience. And that can happen moving. That can happen sitting. So for yoga, that's the instruction to keep close to the heart, is prana, mind, inseparable. Those three words, prana, mind, inseparable. Lungsem Yerme. And that's like the pith instruction. That's really the sense of what was in that scroll, was just that. And then many exercises that you can do to bring prana, mind, inseparable. But essentially, that's the simplicity of the practice, the simplicity, the simple answer.
Could you say again the three words?
Prana.
In Tibetan.
Oh, lung sem yerme. Lung is prana, vayu, prana. Sem, mind, and then yerme is inseparable, fused, utterly one.
Yeah, so great talk. I love this topic. As you were saying earlier, there is an emphasis within the teachings on taking some movement. Going to meditation events and yoga, even I feel like there's this this sense that movement, when you're not instructed to move, is a sign that your mind is disturbed. And I've felt in yoga classes and in meditation things that that I don't want to move. Every time I move, people are going to see me and see that my mind is so messed up or something. And so I wonder if you could talk about that. There seems to be an elephant in the room, just for me at least.
I'm glad you brought that in. There's a place for stillness in practice. There definitely is a place for stilling the body. And there's a certain type of settling that happens, of course, after a while. Like at first, when you still the body, then the mind is just like, right? The mind is just like, when you first still the body. I mean, like if you're really a new meditator. And so if any of you are new meditators, you are not going crazy. This is really quite normal. But eventually there's something about the stillness of the body that allows settling. So there's a place for that. But there's also a place for not becoming neurotic about movement. So I think... in fact, in one way, stillness isn't the end goal of our practice anyway. It's really to be awake. And that wakefulness doesn't care whether we're moving or whether we're still. That wakefulness is not absent when we're moving. So from that perspective, it doesn't matter at all whether we move or sit still. But on a relative level, for like a long life of training, it's really helpful to have some periods of stillness where we are allowing the settling, really for the purposes of getting more intimate with the stream of our being and discovering that there's space. It's not just content. That's a great question. Elephant in the room.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the stillness that comes before the movement, you know, the first year and a half of your retreat and the first couple years of Milarepa's meditation and having to hit a bottom, which I think is really interesting. And is it necessary to not move before we can have the rewards of the movement?
No, I don't think so. I actually still think that's a, I think that's a problem of the way that I, well, no, I can't generalize. I can say the way, in my training, I think it was a problem that we didn't earlier on have more access to the notion that movement can be wakeful, utterly, that we didn't have that introduced earlier. I think especially as Westerners, because when we hear the word mind, Westerners, me, I don't know about you all, but when I heard that word as a young person, I think that probably intellectually, or I would say, I wouldn't have said this, but some part of me interpreted the idea of mind as brain. And we think of mind as being just the intellectual side of ourselves. So when we hear things like, you want to transform your mind, we're thinking of something almost disembodied. I was, anyway. And in fact, if you ask a person from most countries in Asia to point to their mind, their citta in Sanskrit, or their citta in Pali, or their sem in Tibetan, or I don't know what it is in Japanese or Chinese, but if you ask them to point to that, where do they point? Yes, that's right. They point here. They don't point here. They point here. It's a much more embodied notion of what mind is. So I was going somewhere with this. What was your question?
You were saying that the initial stillness is not necessary, that we should start moving earlier, right away.
Oh, I just think the stillness is important, that shamatha is important, but incorporating movement early in our training, either if it's walking meditation is a great way to do it, or whatever it is, yoga, tai chi, qigong, as part of our sadhana, part of our meditation session before, during, after, somewhere in there, can help us not get into this space of being so mentalized in our practice. And I think that, at least for me, that was an issue. Because when I would hear the word mind, like you need to work with your mind, and it's your monkey mind, and you're looking for the nature of mind, I kept hearing something that I think I didn't fully understand is all over this organism, that we're a psychophysical organism, and that waking up is a psychophysical process. It's not just a mental event. But yeah, I think the stillness still has its place, and it's really critical. I think critical if we're training in meditation to have some degree of experience of stillness in our practice so that we can slow down enough to find the things that we need to find in the practice, our deeper nature, to have vipassana, to have insight. We have to have something, some stillness. But the movement is so important that the mindful movement is so important for integration and also for breaking down this notion that awakening is going to happen in our brain or something alone, as if it was some isolated thing. It's important to have the body involved. Yeah.
Now, Larry wrote a book on 3 steps to awakening. Now, being awake is just being aware of what's happening at a certain... Being awake is just being aware of what's going on, right? Simple?
Simple. There's a term for awakeness or wakefulness you find in some traditions, and the term is ordinary awareness. That what we're seeking is ordinary awareness, Tamal Jishepa, ordinary awareness. We're not seeking something exotic. Wakefulness is not exotic. Wakefulness is naked, present awareness. So there's a simplicity to it. And yet it's so very simple that we overlook it. There is a possibility that we will commodify it and grasp it as this thing that it isn't. In fact, it's inevitable. We're going to do that. We're going to do that for many times and mistake after mistake. So, but yeah, I like that you brought that up. It's simple. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
An add-on question to that is, I've heard a lot of stories about you, very experienced people being very determined to go somewhere and sit still until an
awakening happens. But I'm just curious to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, is it an achievement? Is it something you get to and then you know what that is and therefore you are that, or is it more of a spectrum that where levels of awakeness can sort of come and go, and you are, you know, in a more awake state at certain times than others? Just curious how you perceive that.
Wakefulness is not a state in one way. So wakefulness is innate. Wakefulness is primordial. And the process, therefore, of meditation is not an acquisition of something. It's a discovery of something that is already present. That isn't to say that we see it. There's one of my teachers used to say it's like the tip of your nose. It's so close, you can't see it very clearly. It's too close. It's too intimate. So we overlook it. But practice and working for a while on a path, especially with community and guides, is important, or some kind of curriculum of development, then you have a way to glimpse and sustain that wakefulness. It's already there, but sustain a relationship to it, a connection to it. Yeah, that's how I see it. This has been so lovely to be with all of you this evening. And I'd like to wrap up with a dedication. Dedication is just a paying forward. So we'll take a moment just to pay forward just the intention that whatever we have practiced and learned, may it be of benefit to all beings, to our loved ones, to those who are suffering, and to those who wish to be free. Thank you. And feel free to come up and say hello after.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.